It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the rise of the water recycling movement, turning sewage into drinking water in water-stressed states, and what Wisconsin can learn from the technology. Be part of this discussion. Call in with a question. Add your comments along the way. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Peter Annan is director of the Mary Griggs Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation at Northland College in Ashland. New book is called Purified: How Recycled Sewage is Transforming Our Water. Peter, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. It's good to be with you.
Good to be with you. As we're going to start here at Grassland Dairy in Eau Claire. The farm has its own direct water reuse system right on the farm, and you call it the most cutting-edge form of water recycling in water-rich Wisconsin. How often are people in our state drinking recycled wastewater?
Yeah, we're it depends on how you look at it, but technically we're not drinking it yet here, but many other states, especially in the Sun Belt, are. And what's really cool about Grassland is they're sort of at the cutting edge of this national movement. And yeah, they're using one of the most technical, complicated forms of potable water recycling. They're on the farm and kind of quietly doing it. And, you know, they're one of the largest butter producers in the country.
So what you're saying is they're not using their local water resources and they are recycling their wastewater on the farm as kind of a standalone operation for using wastewater.
That's right. Yeah. So they're in a unique situation, you know, as we have the largest lake in the world, Lake Superior, on the northern side of the state, and the largest inland lake within the lower 48 and Lake Michigan. And then we have the largest river in the country to our west and the Mississippi River. And yet Grassland happened to be located in this area where there's not a lot of available groundwater, surface water. So for a while, they were trucking in water from the local utility, and then they decided to invest in this cutting-edge sewage recycling, water recycling program that not only provides a new, clean, safe drinking water supply for the cows on the farm, even though they're actually not using it for drinking water for the cows at the moment, they could, but it also reduces the sewage discharging that they would do from the farm as well. So it's kind of a win-win in many ways.
You write that people's attitudes toward turning sewer water into drinking water, it's changing from dissent to enthusiasm. And this is a big movement. So for people living in the Midwest and near the Great Lakes, is drinking water at all in danger of being depleted?
In the Great Lakes region, no. Hmm. No, it's not. But what we see is Los Angeles has pledged to recycle 100% of its sewage into drinking water by 2035. Orange County, California, already is recycling 100% of its sewage for millions of people in that area of California. San Diego has pledged to recycle more than 50% of its sewage by 2035 as well. That's just in California. There's places in Texas, Florida, Virginia, again, many places throughout the Sun Belt that are investing heavily in this new technology. And that just goes to show you how severe the water crisis, the climate-driven water crisis, has become in so many parts of the country.
We're talking about recycling wastewater. Peter Annan is here of Northland College in Ashland, author of the new book, Purified: How Recycled Sewage is Transforming Our Water. You can join in questions and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Peter, where do people get their water if wastewater recycling is inaccessible?
Wastewater recycling is accessible everywhere if you've invested in the technology. Mm-hmm. But most people get their drinking water either from surface waters like rivers and lakes, like many people in Wisconsin. Others get their drinking water from the ground, like the city of Madison and other places. So those are the most common options. And what I explore in the book is that the water crisis becomes so severe in so many parts of the Sun Belt that many of those traditional supplies have been exhausted, and that in many of those areas, there are only two realistic options left: the ocean and the toilet. And many people are very familiar with ocean desalination, but many are not familiar with turning sewage and purifying it into drinking water. And so that's why I wrote the book. And what we're seeing, as you mentioned, Kate, is this amazing movement of investment in this area by water managers who realize that this is the lowest hanging fruit when your back's against the wall. And it's much, much cheaper and more sustainable than ocean desalination. So that's why we're seeing this big boom in water recycling in so much of the country.
Well, what about moving pipelines of water? I mean, we have the Great Lakes Compact, banning long-range, large-scale water diversions from the Great Lakes. Does that compact effectively protect the Great Lakes from water scarcity?
Yeah, and so the Great Lakes Compact is celebrating its 15th anniversary this year, and I describe it as a legal water fence designed to keep Great Lakes water inside the Great Lakes watershed. That's what my last book was about, the Great Lakes Water Wars. And so, but what we're seeing that definitely protects the Great Lakes watershed now, which was very forward-looking on behalf of the governors and premiers in the Great Lakes region, which drove that initiative. But what we're seeing now with the Great Lakes protected is increasing calls for diverting water from the Mississippi River to the southwest, particularly from the state of Arizona. And I argue in the book that that's the last century's way of doing things, and it's remarkably unsustainable. It doesn't make sense to steal water from one watershed and send it to another. And the timing of these proposals is really ironic, given that the Mississippi River is going through historically low flows of its own right now. And so, again, what we're seeing in the climate change era is water scarcity is so severe that it's prompting a really new way of looking at our water supplies and water scarce areas, and then water recycling followed by desal are really the best options that people have, which is why we're seeing that boom that I talked about.
And I was really, it was eye-opening when you walk us through how the engineering really isn't even feasible to move such a vast quantity of water from the Midwest to parts of like Arizona and elsewhere.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, when you think about it, you're going uphill all the way to the Rocky Mountains, and then you're going really uphill to cross or go through the Rocky Mountains. And we're talking about thousands of miles. And yeah, it's what, when you break it down, when you think about it, it really doesn't make sense. And I got into the water diversion issue extensively in the last book as well. And it's sort of natural to think this is a way to go about it, sort of in a knee-jerk way. But the more people investigate it, the more they realize how unsustainable it is. I mean, just imagine the carbon footprint of moving all that water uphill. In the state of California, they have a big water diversion program, and it is the single largest carbon footprint in the entire state. So it's just not sustainable, and we need to let go of the idea.
Peter Annan leads a water innovation center at Northland College in Ashland. New book is called Purified. It takes us to communities around America to meet water recycling leaders who are turning sewage into safe drinking water. Call in at any point to ask a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. As the effects of climate change squeeze water supplies in large swaths of the country, environmental journalist Peter Annan writes how sewage has emerged as a surprising solution that can bring badly needed relief to water-stressed communities. Annan directs the Burke Center for Water Innovation at Northland College in Ashland. New book is called Purified, and you can join the discussion. Field your question, add comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Peter, you explain the common yuck response people have to the idea of recycling wastewater from toilets. Is recycled wastewater safe to drink?
It absolutely is. Yeah, and it is the natural reaction that most people have. But these treatment systems are so high tech, and they've been in many parts, or I should say not many, but in increasing parts of the country. They've been online and serving customers, millions of customers, in a place like Orange County, which is the national, if not international, leader in this movement for many years now without incident. They're absolutely safe. And what we're seeing is that it just takes time. And the pattern is very similar. The idea might be proposed to a community. The initial reaction is, uh-oh, this is not a cool thing. And then over time, people become more and more comfortable with the technology, often in direct relationship to how scarce their drinking water supplies become because of climate-driven drought, et cetera.
So there's the drought, there's water restrictions, there's climate change that are all impacting people's impression of this technology. Can you walk us through here? What process does wastewater go through to become clean?
Yeah, so first of all, you start with traditional wastewater effluent that's discharged from a sewage treatment plant. That is required to meet Clean Water Act standards from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. So that's what normally in cities around the country is discharged into rivers, lakes, and oceans. And again, has strict rules and regulations on its quality. But rather than discharge that into surface waters, water recycling programs then take that water and they first run it through what's called microfiltration, which takes out what I call sort of the big microscopic stuff. That's like protozoa, bacteria, viruses. We're talking about things like Giardia, Cryptosporidium, et cetera. Then, taking Orange County as an example, it moves on to reverse osmosis, which is the real tough scrubbing that goes on. And that removes chemicals, pharmaceuticals, pesticides, PFAS, and then any viruses that may have been missed from the prior level of treatment and microfiltration. Then after that, we basically are dealing with water that is now akin to distilled water. In fact, it's so pure, minerals need to be added back to that water so that it doesn't leach minerals from the concrete conveyance pipes that take water to the community. But then there's yet one other layer of treatment, which is ultraviolet disinfection with hydrogen peroxide. That is basically redundant to the reverse osmosis level that I talked about earlier. And it's just that extra step. And then what Orange County does is they take that water and then they discharge it into the ground, which for several months, it mixes with the groundwater that is already there. Then it's withdrawn from the ground by the water department that's serving different communities in Orange County. It's treated again by the water department before it's delivered to homes and businesses in the area. So pretty extensive.
You write about this incident in Orange County where acetone was illegally dumped into the sewer system near a wastewater recycling plant. It didn't enter the drinking water system. What protections are in place if contaminants do leach or get through the treatment process?
Yeah, really great question. I think the secret bullet in these facilities is their high-tech real-time monitoring. They're monitoring the water as it moves through the entire system in real time. And this is one of the exclusive things in the book that had not been reported before. But Orange County had this situation where an industrial customer is believed to have dumped a large amount of acetone in the sewer system, as you said, and it was went through the sewage treatment plant and it was undetected. And then we have the real-time monitoring in the water recycling plant picked it up. They saw it come into the plant. They saw it go up in their graphs, watching it. They saw that it didn't exceed the permit of amount of the chemical. So we're talking about really, really trace amounts anyway. And then it went back down again. And so they didn't shut down the plant, which would have been their protocol. And then it went through and then was again discharged into the groundwater system. And state officials in California assure the public that they were, and there's also a lot of real-time monitoring of the groundwater system because of what's going on with this water treatment system that they have in Orange County. And the acetone was never detected in the groundwater system. And so, as alarming as that may sound to the public, the officials at Orange County say, told me in the book, look, the system worked. We saw it come in. We're monitoring it real time. We saw that it didn't exceed our permit levels, which means it's really, really in small trace amounts. And then we let it go into the groundwater system, which serves as what they call, quote unquote, an environmental buffer in some of these water recycling programs. And so, but even then, I think today, mainly for public perception reasons, they would probably shut the plant down just so, because it doesn't alarm the public, even though the public really shouldn't be alarmed.
Peter Annan of Northland College, author of Purified: How Recycled Sewage is Transforming Our Water. You can join in. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Steve in Lake Geneva. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Yes, hi there. This is interesting. So they're using reverse osmosis to filter out the pharmaceuticals. We know there's a vast number of pharmaceuticals which are sold and used in this country. Formulas are proprietary. How does this system actually work? I mean, in terms of detection, is it detecting, like, I mean, there are obviously trace amounts. And then what does the waste look like that's captured? How is it treated? Just curious, because obviously you got the pharmaceuticals, also the so-called illicit substances that people are using when they have drug dependencies. I'd just like to better understand how that works. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve. Go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, and again, reverse osmosis is screening all of this out, and they're detecting the water throughout the process, and before the water gets to the reverse osmosis system and after the reverse osmosis system. And then they're testing that water for everything that could possibly be in there. And again, including PFAS. I mean, the irony is, if you want PFAS-free water, you want to be drinking recycled sewage. That's how extensive the treatment systems are here. And I think for the audience to get any deeper into that, Kate, I think we'd lose a lot of people. But it's the fact of the matter is that this is a process that's been in Orange County in production for many, many years in producing this recycled sewage. And it's got numerous additional levels beyond the reverse osmosis, as I said, with UV, ultraviolet, and hydrogen peroxide as an additional layer. And when that water is out and they test it, there's nothing in it and so much missing that they have to add minerals back in. It's really, again, akin to distilled water, but it's not distilled because it doesn't go through the distillation process.
So where do they dispose of the waste and what they scrub out in the process? Where does the brine go?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So if you think again, we sort of, and a lot of people aren't even familiar with how the wastewater system works, but the wastewater system, you have this water that's normally treated to Clean Water Act standards, and then that is all discharged into a surface water. With recycled water, that clean water is removed, and then you have a more concentrated waste stream. So all the stuff that used to be in the waste stream is still in the waste stream, but you've taken a bunch of water out of that, and that goes into the surface water as it has before. And so you still have to discharge that into the surface water. It's just you're taking as much of the potable water out of it before you do so. Yeah, really good question.
Okay, and so that is something, though, that these treatment centers would need to grapple with, is what you do with all of the things that are coming out of that water to become clean water. Peter Annan with us traces the rise of recycled sewage as communities look to a more sustainable alternative than piping water into the drought-stricken Southwest, as we talked about earlier. New book is called Purified. You can be part of this discussion. Call in with a question. You can share your views on water. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Purified sewage for drinking water could be the way water-stressed regions of America cope with rapidly depleting freshwater supplies. We explore what Wisconsin could learn from municipalities engineering their own potable water reuse systems. Call in with a question, share perspectives, 800-642-1234. Peter Annan directs the Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation at Northland College. New book is called Purified. Peter, we heard from Frank in Springbrook, called in, and Frank's curious on the water issues in the Southwest and says it seems that area of the country is growing and growing and growing, and no one is afraid of the water issues. Is water scarcity slowing development in the Southwest?
Yeah, it's a great question, Frank. So what we're seeing is the Southwest is in the midst of the worst drought in 1,200 years. And we have the atmospheric rivers of 2023 that helped pull most of California out of that drought. But that has not been the case in the Colorado River system, which provides water to 40 million people in the Southwest. Lake Mead, the largest reservoir in the country on the Colorado River, is in what's called a tier one designated shortage, which is not a good place to be. The atmospheric rivers brought it out of a tier two shortage, which had never been reached before in the history of the reservoir. And so, yeah, what we're seeing is a lot of concern in the Colorado River watershed in particular about this drought that's climate driven. And again, the worst in 1,200 years. And let's just think about that for a little bit, because things have gotten so severe on the Colorado River watershed that they're talking about something called Deadpool. Deadpool is when the levels in Lake Mead or Lake Powell, the reservoir farther upstream, go so low that water no longer passes through Hoover Dam. Hmm. So then you have a water crisis, but you also have an energy crisis because millions of people are dependent on the power produced by the dams on Lake Mead and Lake Powell. Then you also have a food crisis because 80% of the Colorado River's water is used for agriculture, mainly vegetables and nuts and fruits that are shipped throughout the country and the world. So it is a very, very serious situation. Frank's absolutely right. And yes, these are some of the fastest growing states and major cities in the country. And what we are seeing in the state of Arizona, for example, is conversations about limiting development because of a lack of access to water supplies. Arizona requires you have to prove that you have 100 years of water, which many people outside of Arizona think isn't enough because a lot of homes, especially in the eastern part of the country, are a lot older than 100 years. But that's their traditional bar that you have to cross. And now some developers are unable to prove that there's even 100 years of water. And so we are starting to see that pinch point, especially in the Phoenix area.
Let's bring in Paul in Madison with an eye on agriculture. Paul, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I spent a fair amount of time living in Arizona and New Mexico, and I'm very familiar with the water issues. I think one thing we should do is to look at some agricultural crops that could be grown back east, and pecans that are grown, for example, in New Mexico could be grown in Georgia. In fact, many of them are. But things like corn and soybeans and alfalfa should not be grown in a water shortage area. So we should maybe figure out a way to buy off the farmers and convert that water for other more uses for humans.
Paul, thank you for that. And Peter, what about the crops and the cows and what is viable in the Southwest?
You know, that's a really, really good question, Paul. And you're absolutely right. So as I just said, 80% of the water in the Colorado River watershed is going to agriculture. And in many cases, it's going to unsustainable practices of agriculture. There are huge alfalfa crops in Arizona that could indeed be grown elsewhere. Some of the largest dairy farms in the country are in Arizona. And I get into all this in the book. And what we're seeing, in fact, dairy is the largest agricultural sector in Arizona, which I was shocked to learn in reporting and research for the book. And so, yeah, think of that, right? So we have a lot of unsustainable, heavy agricultural use in the state of Arizona, which could be reduced or bought out by urban areas. And that is happening in some cases. But what we're seeing in many parts of the Southwest is those farms that have the best water rights don't want to sell. And so that creates this ag-urban water tension, not just in Arizona, but throughout the Southwest. And so what you're seeing, again, with this water recycling movement is metropolitan water managers are like, fine, if we can't get that water from agriculture, then we're so desperate that we're actually looking at sewage as a drinking water supply. And so it's a really great point, Paul. I completely agree. And I get to it in all those issues extensively in the book.
Let's go to Kyle in Winneconne. Kyle, hi.
I was just wondering why Orange County would do hydrogen peroxide in that second two-step of purification. Is hydrogen peroxide something we really want in our water?
Kyle, thanks. That was a bit connection, a bit scratchy there, Peter. Would we want hydrogen peroxide in the water?
Yeah, so the hydrogen peroxide isn't in the water. It's a little bit complicated. It's used to clean the water, but it's not in the water afterwards. And so it's complicated, hard to explain, and we're, you know, going through it pretty quickly here, on the radio here, Kate, but these are all really great questions. I mean, I think it's important for a couple things for people to realize, right? Which is that these questions have been asked for decades, especially in states like California. California, of course, is famous for having some of the strictest regulatory requirements on all sorts of things. In the nation, we see these labels that, you know, this causes cancer in California, et cetera. We don't see that for other states. And this California is the leading state in the United States in terms of potable water recycling. And here's another thing that I get into the book, right, is that if you live on a river, you have been drinking water that is diluted sewage from cities upstream. And we have been drinking recycled water in the, you know, as the book says, for centuries. In fact, there's a doctor quoted in the book, we're drinking dinosaur pee now because we have this water cycle that the water keeps getting recycled again and again and again. But if you think about it, say, you know, with one of the largest municipal areas in the upper Midwest is the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. They discharge their treated effluent under Clean Water Act standards into the Mississippi River. Communities downstream withdraw that water from the river and treat it to Clean Drinking Water Act standards and then serve it to their customers. All the stuff that we talked about being discharged into that river is then being filtered out by drinking water technologies that are not as strict as the drinking water technologies that are used by potable water recycling plants. And so it's kind of a mind warp to think about this whole thing. But if you live on a river, you have been drinking recycled water, what's called de facto recycled water, for a long time. And there's different things that you can see examples. But by the time that river water gets down to New Orleans, you're talking about heavy use of recycled water.
Talking about recycling wastewater, Peter Annan, our guide of Northland College in Ashland. New book is called Purified. You can join in. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Peter, you write about the importance of public relations in cities recycling wastewater. Why is bad PR, bad public perception of this wastewater technology so detrimental?
Yeah, it's what I say in the book is that if you are going to try to convince people that it's safe to drink sewage, you really need to have a top-notch public relations effort. In fact, I say that your top-notch scientific effort needs to be as top-notch as your public relations effort, and vice versa. And again, as we've discussed, and I appreciate some of the skeptical calls, that's completely normal, and it happens again and again and again in these different instances. And what we have seen repeatedly throughout water recycling history, if a utility or a city tries to initiate a new water recycling program and they're cutting corners on public relations, or they aren't investing enough in outreach to the community, that these programs tend to run into problems. And what we saw that in San Diego in the 1990s. Probably the most famous implosion of a potable water recycling program. But then here we are a couple of decades later, and they're investing billions of dollars in a potable water recycling program that, as I said, is scheduled to produce 50% of the drinking water for the second largest city in California by 2035. So it's, you know, public relations or just communication with average citizens, decision makers, et cetera, about the ins and outs of these programs to answer all these great questions that the listeners have been asking has proven to be extremely crucial in these water recycling programs.
And let's bring in another question. Gary in Ripon. Gary, hi. Go ahead.
Yes. How much does it cost to recycle this water, and how much electricity does it use?
Peter, go ahead.
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's one of the key questions, Gary, that gets asked as well. And so what we see is if you use desalination as a baseline, its biggest problem is that it uses a lot of energy to remove that salt from the water to create drinking water. And it has a much higher carbon footprint than water recycling does. So water recycling does use a lot of energy, but it uses less energy than desalination, and it uses less energy than importing water supplies from the Colorado River or, God forbid, the Mississippi River. And so the cheapest and easiest water is coming from the ground, or it's coming from surface waters. And then what we're seeing, depending on where you live, and what your other water options are in your local community, is that water recycling is in the mix, above average, but not the most expensive option. And what we're also seeing with a lot of these water managers is that it's worth the investment because it is a drought-resistant supply. And by that, they mean there will always be sewage to recycle, and you can count on it. And so if you invest in this system, then you know that water is going to be there to recycle, as opposed to, say, a surface water system that's hammered by a 1,200-year climate-driven mega drought or other options that may be out there. Groundwater, what we talk about a lot in the book, is groundwater withdrawals are so extensive in many areas that they can no longer be counted on as a reliable source of supply for many of these large cities.
Peter Annan directs the Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation at Northland College, home to one of the most comprehensive water recycling archives in the country. New book called Purified explains how to turn sewage into drinking water. Call in with a question. Share your views. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin is a water-rich state, but how could we benefit from recycling sewage into clean drinking water? We explore the new book, Purified, with author Peter Annan of Northland College, leads the Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation. And there's space to discuss what you wonder about water recycling. Call in with the question, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Peter, you travel to Texas, where the cities, some of the cities are in a water crisis. They're using recycled wastewater. And you write that staff at these facilities have no margin for error. How is their approach to water reuse in Texas different than what you have found in California?
Yeah, so what we saw in 2011, Texas had the single driest year in recorded history. And that drought lasted for years in certain parts of the state, particularly Wichita Falls, northwest of Dallas, and then a town called Big Spring out in the oil patch in West Texas. And Big Spring went first. It literally got down to the point where they only had months of water left in their system. And so they reached out to the state of officials in Texas and got emergency permission to use this high-tech version of water recycling called direct potable reuse. I mentioned about Orange County system where the water is recycled and then it indirectly is served to customers by having it pass through the groundwater mm-hmm. as an environmental buffer first. But in Texas, it's faster and easier to install a direct potable reuse system, even though the technology is more cutting edge. It's actually faster because you don't have to deal with a reservoir or a groundwater system as a buffer. And so officials in Texas gave Big Spring emergency permission to install this direct potable reuse system. And because there isn't that environmental buffer, if the acetone were to pass through that system and you were not to catch it, then it's going to go straight into the drinking water system, which is why that is the most controversial, but also cutting edge form of water recycling. And so what we had was a direct potable reuse system in Big Spring, Texas. And then a year or two later, we had another direct potable reuse system in Wichita Falls. And what was really fascinating about the Texas situation is how widespread the support was for these potable water recycling systems in that state. You had a gentleman in Big Spring who was quoted in the paper saying that he looked forward to drinking his beer twice. In Wichita Falls, they had the community members started printing t-shirts. We put the number 2 and H2O. And so there's real sense of humor about it all. And the takeaway from the Big Spring and Wichita Falls case studies is that if you wait until it's almost too late, potable water recycling can be really, really popular. In fact, in Wichita Falls, over time, they segued back to an indirect potable reuse system after their emergency was over. And that's when the controversy erupted. And the public was very concerned by letting go of direct potable reuse. They might be vulnerable to the next drought. And sooner or later, in a place like Texas, drought is definitely going to come back. And so that's when the complaints came in. And the other reason the complaints came in is that the recycled water tasted better. It just tasted better than the old water. And so it was really remarkable when you juxtapose the controversy in places like San Diego with the lack of controversy, in fact, robust enthusiasm for water recycling in Texas. It just goes to show you that not all places react to this concept in the same way.
Enter the regulators. You really set up a contrast between what's happening in Texas and what's happening in California in the regulatory space. How should state and federal environmental regulators ensure safety?
Yeah, well, this is the issue, right? And there is a debate that's going on in the industry between sort of the California approach and the Texas approach. Texas does not have direct potable reuse water recycling regulations. They approve each application on a case-by-case basis, and they have approved more of these water recycling programs than any other state. Meanwhile, while all that has been happening, California, in a kind of classic California-Texas juxtaposition, has been spending years creating comprehensive regulations for this cutting-edge approach to water recycling called direct potable reuse. And those are going to be released later on this month. And so you have a case where, you know, the regulation is super strict and they have never approved a direct potable reuse water recycling program in California, while you have no overriding regulations in Texas and they've approved three so far. So again, kind of a classic Texas-California situation. But it could create confusion and controversy going forward to have so many different rules and regulations with this cutting edge technology.
Going forward, you write that the federal government has increasingly embraced water recycling, and that includes $1 billion in the bipartisan infrastructure law. How is federal support affecting what is possible here in the water recycling movement?
That's right. There's something called the Water Reuse Action Plan was released by the United States Environmental Protection Agency a few years ago. And that is helping to sort of bridge the gap between these different state regulations. The federal regulations that oversee water recycling are the same that oversee drinking water throughout the country, which is the Federal Drinking Water Standards. But what we're definitely seeing is the federal government coming in, increasingly embracing water recycling, not only supporting it from a sort of a communication standpoint with the Water Reuse Action Plan, but also federal funding for these programs in many parts of the Sun Belt.
In our last minute together, Frankie from Fort Atkinson called and wants to know, how does this treatment process help the environment and natural resources over the long term?
Right. Yeah, great question. I mean, when you think about it, recycling is inherently sustainable. And that goes with whether you're talking about paper or plastic, and it's true with water as well. And we're seeing the waste streams are smaller. As we discussed, they're more concentrated, but they're smaller. And by reusing water, instead of taking it more water from the environment, we are leaving more water for plants, animals, and the environment behind.
And so that, in turn, can have a ripple effect on the larger ecosystem and the environment itself.
That's exactly right. It means humans will inherently be using less water, leaving more for the broader environment. Exactly.
Peter, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Good to be with you.
Peter Annan is director of the Mary Griggs Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation at Northland College in Ashland. His new book is called Purified: How Recycled Sewage is Transforming Our Water. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.